Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Rebecca Ferguson joins us to talk about Dune Part 2, and we give you our final Oscar predictions.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 301 of Real Blend, a podcast that is ready to lose to Jake in the Oscars competition. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at Cinema Blend, and on this week's show, Dune Blend continues. As discussed, the month of March on the Real Blend podcast is dedicated to the beauty that is Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2. Hopefully you enjoyed Greg Fraser to this point and Denis Villeneuve. And on this week's episode, the lovely and talented Rebecca Ferguson joins the show to discuss not just Dune Part 2 and the original Dune, but her career, including her take on the fake of Tremblay story, which I know that the real ones are dying to hear. So we'll get to that in a second. Of course, we're going to give our final Oscar predictions ahead of the Academy Awards show. Let me introduce the boys, however, starting with Jake Hamilton. We're going to start 301 with Jake. Let the count continue.
I got to tell you, so I'm going to go ahead and put this out there. I was not able to participate in the Rebecca Ferguson interview because I was with Bill Murray that day doing a Bill Murray interview.
What a disgusting name drop.
I had to put that out there because I think most people's initial reaction would be, what on earth could possibly keep you from interviewing the incredible Rebecca Ferguson? I did not know up until this moment that you guys talked to her about the fake up Tremblay story. I did not know that.
Had to. How are we not going to bring that up?
I was just about to say, well, what'd she say? But I guess I could just listen to the interview.
Did you see online, they were talking about her, she had like a quick aside where, or there was a quote where she was talking about not working with an actor because they screamed at her on set. And there were, you know, very serious thing, but it turned into an internet thing. And someone said it was Jacob Tremblay on
Dr. Sleep. I just love how quickly The Rock came out on social media to like put a statement out there being like, I can't believe this happened. And the first thing I thought of whenever I saw that was like, oh, you really want to make sure people don't think it's you.
Right. Well, I saw a lot of people kind of guessing it was him. And I didn't even remember they were in a film.
I didn't realize she was in Hercules.
Oh, was she in that film? Jeez, oh, Pete. All right. Well, anyway.
I forgot it was a movie.
Kev McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev. How are you?
Hi, Jonathan. How are you? Jacob. Sometimes, Gabriel. Good to see you guys.
Kevathan.
Sometimes I get my foxes mixed up when I switch the order of when I'm interviewing you guys. All right. We got a lot of show we're going to get to. If you're watching us on YouTube, hello. Thank you very much for joining us. We're proud to... we're very happy to have you here, and we hope that you enjoy the show. Hit subscribe, turn on your notifications, share the show with a film-loving friend. If you're listening in audio format and want to see our smiling, handsome faces, and also follow along with Rebecca Ferguson in video format, go to youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast. Of course, we're available all the different places you get your podcast needs met. We also have a premium service. If you would like to subscribe to Real Blend Premium, it gets you an ad-free version of the show and a newsletter from me, which should be coming this week. I'm mentioning to everybody right now that we're recording this episode a little bit early. It's the Oscars prediction. We already had Rebecca banked. We're going to breeze through the Oscar categories as quickly as we can. But that's one where we like to take our time, get through all the different categories, talk about what's been nominated. And then, like I said, lose to Jake eventually in what used to be an elaborate bet. And I think we've kind of just given up the ghost on that one.
Here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to push back on that a little bit because I think this year, and we'll get into this, it's going to come down to a lot of the below the line categories. And there are a lot of categories that are for me down to about two possible winners.
Okay.
So I think that, I think a lot of the below the line categories are going to be the make and break. This is the least confident I've ever been going into a year, I'll say.
I put Dune Part 2 for everything. Is that
good
okay?
Call. Oh, yeah. Please.
You're going to be batting over 500.
Okay, good. Yeah. That's not too bad then.
Yeah. That gets me in the Hall of Fame.
There you go. Speaking of Doom Part 2, Rebecca Ferguson. I mean, her credits are unbelievably great. We mentioned Dr. Sleep, the Mission franchise, of which we talked at length with her about, and her contributions to the Dune franchise, remarkable.
Silo.
Her role in Part 2 is expanded and is even better. Silo, an excellent show on Apple TV Plus as well, too. And on the Rebel Land podcast. So let's throw it right to our interview with Rebecca, because we're thrilled to have her on. This is a really great conversation. You can go scan through Jake's social media feed to find his picture with Bill Murray, because he had to put that up there as well, too. And here's Rebecca Ferguson on the Rebel Land podcast.
Oh, my God, that's great. Let's do this. Let's break this down.
And we adore you. Also,
oh, thank you. Should I swear? Can I swear or not?
You please, yes, as much as possible.
Oh, fuck yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
All right, look, I'm going to start because we only have 30 minutes. We have about a million questions we want to get to. So I want to start with this.
I've got them. Yep, I've got them.
You got us?
I've got them both.
Terrific. And me. Hello, how are you?
Hi.
Good to see you. It's so good to see you.
So nice to see you
Between this film, the two Dune films, the Mission films, you're lucky enough to work with directors who value shooting on location. And speaking with Denis just yesterday, he talked about how nature was essentially, you know, a main character in the narrative. It's as important as just about anybody else. I want to find out from you, like, what's the most valuable benefit for you as a performer being able to shoot on location and to actually tangibly feel those places?
I mean, can you imagine someone answering, oh God, I love me some blue screen, you know, when you have no depth or feeling or heat or tactility. Is that even a word? I'm going to go with it. Sure. Thank you. But that is it, isn't it? The fact is the dimension, the depth, running away, running towards, grabbing, difficulties, sand. Sand is hard to walk in, guys. It's tricky. Yeah. The mountains and the rocks and I mean, come on. It's just, it puts you in a state of mind of realism within quotation marks.
When I'm on vacation, if I'm walking across the sand, I make it about 10 minutes before I throw all of our shit down. And I'm like, we're here for the day. That's it.
I thought you were saying,
I don't know how you guys.
I thought you were going to go until I start doing the sand walk. I thought you were going like, and a jump and a swish and a tap. Well,
now I know it. Now I'll utilize it.
Yeah. But also we're not carrying too many things. I mean, when you go on a walk with your family, it's like, oh God, and the thing and the come on, child. You know, I had a bit of that in June 1, but you know.
Yeah, very true.
You know, Rebecca, there's a quote in Frank Herbert's original book, but also in the end of the first movie that has like really stuck with me. And I'm on a personal note, I'm turning 40 this year. So I've been trying to utilize this aspect in my life and just kind of remaining present and just kind of going with the flow of the process. But the quote is, the mystery of life isn't a problem to solve, but a reality to experience. And I think that's a really beautiful way. And that was written in the 60s, and it couldn't be more relevant to today and kind of how disconnected we are as a society. And I just wanted to ask you how that line resonates with you in your own life and how you choose to live your life, because you're going a million miles a minute. You're doing movies and TV shows, your family. I mean, I don't know how you juggle and stay present. So what does that line mean to you?
Can you say it again?
The mystery of life isn't a problem to solve, but a reality to experience.
But I mean, do you know what I think? I'm going to not be geeky, but isn't it a mixture though? Because as intelligent beings, I like questioning and thinking and planning. And even though this, I don't know if this is weird or odd, but I remember back in the day when I did a lot of casting tapes, right? You know, now I'm so famous, I just get roles. I'm kidding. It sounds absolutely ridiculous. Nowadays.
You're actually not kidding.
No. You're not kidding.
You're not kidding.
Guys, I made a tape 2 weeks ago.
What?
A director asked me to make a tape. He asks everyone to make tapes. It doesn't matter who you are. And it was one of the best things I've ever done. But anyway, moving on. Oh. It was phenomenal. My point is, And it answers the question in somewhat way for me. I remember going in, doing those tapes and thinking, I have no idea if I'm going to get it. But the idea of getting it, and I started building up this world, and maybe it's something I do, was living in a pre-planned universe for myself. That even if it was going to be turned down, that moment, living in the analogy merged, was exciting for me.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a mixture for me. I create worlds and live in them. Or should we do this? Should we go on this journey? And the research and all of this becomes my environment. Does that make sense?
No, 100%. It makes sense. And we talk about this a lot of times, too, in terms of like doing these interviews. There's no way to practice them. You know, like there's no way for you to practice auditioning or doing a tape. Like, so you cling to almost every opportunity that you get to do it.
It was probably one of the most exciting things I've ever done, because this specific director, he works a lot with improvisation. And it was just putting my mind in a state of being and putting me in a catharsism and chaos environment. And I brought my hubby along and I went, right, are you ready? This is the scenario. And I put a camera up and we sat down and we just fucking went for it. I was so impressed with how he took the stick and just ran with it. And it was a 7-minute long scene that just went all over the place. I was so proud of it. I kept on showing it to everyone on set.
And that director's name was...
Yeah. You will know if I get the role.
Rebecca, it's 20 years ago you made your film acting debut in Drowning Ghost. And I find that to be interesting, because you're thinking about like the career you've had in those 20 years. And I wonder how reflective you are of that journey and of that first experience and kind of what that film. Like, do you still think back to that film at all when you're making the stuff like Dune and Mission? Because that must have been that was a big experience for you, I would imagine.
No, it wasn't.
No?
No. I'm sorry. It just wasn't. It wasn't.
Oh.
I think for me, my big experience was, like, the thing for me was the soap opera, to be honest. The first thing I was ever cast in was a soap opera, and it was prime time. We filmed 2.5 episodes a day, and I had never acted. And I remember the feeling of the first day on set, how it worked, how many people that came together to make things work. And I remember that feeling that I kind of belonged there. I enjoyed it. I was always very nervous of having attention in school. And when you had to do sort of recites and speak in front of class, I would blush like cauliflowers all over, but I felt so safe behind a camera. And then I remember when I did The White Queen, and I've said this before, it was me and Mike Zions, and we were sitting on our thrones, and we looked out over all of these people, hundreds of people, and I said, we're Queen and King of England. Like, what the fuck happened? How did I get this role, you know? I have those moments throughout my career. Drowning Ghost, funnily enough, is not one of them.
Wow. And that's your first feature film, though, right?
Well, I think for me, it's not to say it wasn't, and I'm not going to lie, it was probably a great moment. But A One-Way Ticket to Antibes was a film which was so big for me, because it was sort of a lead role in a cinema movie by another good director. And Sven Battle-Torb, who's a musician, really famous in Sweden. And that is where my career took off, when agents saw that and just fun, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, and then you look at now, I mean, even I was doing an interview and they said, what does it feel like being a part of this cast? And you think, I remember when I was nominated for a Golden Globe, which, by the way, was bonkers. It was like my TV show. Stepped off the plane into another country and all of this jazz. And it's another story. It's just absolutely ridiculous, my experience of my first red carpet and the puppy. You know, it was just, it's insane.
That's okay. We love those stories.
Well, I remember when I was nominated, number one, I was nominated on best leading actress amongst Helena Bonham Carter, just not Jessica Chastain. Elizabeth Moss won for Top of the Lake, but it was insanity. My stepdad had actually died, and all of these things merged at the same time. So there's a bit of realism in my own life as a juxtaposition to the Hollywood world of superficiality. And I think for me, walking down the carpet, it was just like, it was quite overwhelming. And I remember my first sort of walk, it was the BAFTA Tea Party. Thank you very much. And I didn't have a stylist. I kind of dug into a wardrobe, you know. I didn't know. I didn't know what to wear. And then all of these people, like the photographers and you guys, and it was just like... And then all of a sudden, everyone looked over at me and I was like, wow, this sound and my ego and me. It was like terrified. It was amazing. Until someone went, I'm so sorry, Kate Blanchett is behind you. Would you just move over? Well, can we let Kate take this one? And I was like, yes, this is no good. Of course. Kate, be my guest. And I remember watching her hover. She didn't walk. She fucking hovered out.
Like the Baron.
Like
she was just hovering.
Like the Baron. She hovered, but more elegantly and dreamlined.
Yes. I'm talking about the floating, floating specifically, nothing else.
I know. No, she hovered. She hovered out and she just took this pose and she just did her thing left to right, smiled and walked on. And I was like, okay, I know it's done. And I walked out. I think I like fell. I started talking to the press. I was like, hey, how are you doing? My pictures were like, double chin. I mean, it was just, it was literally the worst thing ever. But it was fun. No.
You have
journey.
No idea how much we appreciate that so much. We want something to shake it up and be different.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want the standard gliding by.
I mean, now I'm fantastic. No, I'm sorry. But no, it was, and I remember also sitting. God, long story. I remember sitting at the table. I remember seeing Matt Damon was there. Someone else was there. All of them were there. I was on the loo. I didn't have loo paper. Drew Barrymore all of a sudden. And she asked me for loo paper. It was all fucking weird. And I didn't belong. I was an imposter. I didn't know what to do with it. And I knew I wasn't going to win. I had no speech. It was just like, get me out of here. But I also really want to be here.
Yeah.
And I think being on set with Denny, looking at Christopher Walken, Charlotte Rampling, Léa Seydoux wasn't there, Florence, Zendaya, Timothy, Austin Butler, it was like, it was that again, but I was in a throne. And it was all that merge, that feeling of, do I belong? Yeah, I'm going to take this position now. I don't really feel it. No, I don't really feel it. I feel really much a part of it. But it's really overwhelming. This world is really, really fucking overwhelming.
Even after the Mission movies, which come with their own machinery?
Mission, I feel, is so episodically defibrillating. It is the moment of filming. It is the moment of training. It is the moment, the promotion, the thing. Mission is the moment.
Yeah.
And then you kind of leave it and you go, what happened? And equally as quickly as it came, is it gone?
Right.
Life kicks in.
Because there's a scene in the most recent one where I'm looking around and it's a standoff. It's in the room. It's Cruz. It's Simon. It's Haley. It's you. It's
Vanessa.
It's Tom. Vanessa. And I'm like, look at this fucking room. You gotta be kidding me. Like, you know, the amount of talent that's here is, you know, it gets overshadowed by the stunts and the action. But like the ensemble is a killer. It's a killer.
What am I going to say? It's in my contract. I just want an ensemble. That's what I want. Do you want a trailer? No, an ensemble.
You know, I want to ask about your relationship to the directors of photography and your composers in the films that you work on. And what I mean by that is, like, when we see the final product of a film, like, you're on set, you're acting, you're performing. Obviously, Greg Fraser is setting up the shots and, like, Denis directing the film. And, but I'm just interested, like, how nerdy are you about, like, talking about the frame with Greg and kind of how much you're in the frame and things like that? And then when you hear your performance set to score by Zimmer, emotionally, what does that give to you that you didn't have on the day? Like, does it enhance what you did for yourself?
Yeah, and I guess there are two different aspects of this, because the first one would be when you filmed number one, when you didn't have the idea of, I mean, how cool is that, by the way? I can't really do it justice, yeah. But just the feeling of the Harkonnens. It's colored into the second one. So it's a different feeling filming the second one, because I know what to expect, yet it's still overthrows you. It's overwhelming. But I want to say that I'm a geek when it came to the books, but that's just going to be a lie. So that's not true, because I didn't grow up reading the books. It was very new to me. So for me, I attacked it from a different angle, and that was through Denis and Denis's mind. And you see him on set going, yeah, oh, I love this, I love this, oh, do, 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 and then this, and then, oh, we should do more of this, or, oh, look at the ornithopters, and then, oh, like, the child in Denis and the eagerness and the joy. And then when I walk onto set looking the way I did, it was literally through the eyes of him where it was like, there it is. Like, that's what I have created, like, together with all of these people, and to be able to portray that and be that person for him, it's phenomenal. It's just, I geek about that. I geek about those details.
Well, Rebecca, there's an important character in the movie that we see in flashes, and it casts a massive shadow over the storyline, and it's Jessica's unborn daughter. And the way that you interact with her and the way that you develop that relationship. Can you just give us some insight into the conversations you and Denis had in terms of how you guys were going to present that visually and how it helped you sort of develop that character?
I'm guessing this podcast comes out after.
After the fact. Yes.
Yeah. After the fact. So when everyone has died. No. what we talked about was, I remember when Denis said, I'm changing it up. You're going to be pregnant throughout the film. I remember thinking, oh, sod off. Am I going to be sexy pregnant or like super big pregnant? Like, what are we talking here? And he was like, big, very big. And then I'm going to put lots of cloth on top of you and then tattoos and then a hat, super high, and then fabric. And I was like, oh, God. And it's actually quite funny because I was in costume with Jackie, costume designer. And I was like, dude, anyone could be behind this veil. I mean, my ego is like, what's happening? And I started taking them off. And I was like, okay, I can leave the chains on, Denny, and I can have tattoos. But other than that, you're not getting a veil. And then we spoke about this fantastic new development of recreating an intelligent being within. Because as we know in the books, the way that she develops and how quickly she grows and the knowledge that she gets through me drinking and the inherited knowledge, the DNA of the generations that go through us. Right. It was like, how do we portray that person? And I was so excited. I mean, we went so far with it and he had to rein it back a bit. I was talking Swedish to the baby. We were having discussions. There were dialogue sequences. She was making me go crazy in my own belief system. We had to rein it back. And then for the storyline, it's not Jessica's story. This is Paul's story. But I think we managed to find a good balance of reigniting and bringing this character of the fetus to life, you know?
Right.
And it was so much fun to work with these inner conversations.
Yeah. Do you remember finding out who was going to play her?
I had no idea until I saw the film.
Really? Yeah. Good surprise. Wow. I won't even say it here, but that's a good surprise. Yeah.
One thing I do want to ask you about in terms of, like, there's a couple things that happen in terms of physicality with your character, the way she moves her fingers when she's signing, but also the concept of the voice that she's using. And I was just curious, on set, when your character does the voice, how much of it is you on set and how much of it is post?
No, I don't actually know the mix of it, but when we do it, I did it very, very forcefully, straight and loud. I don't put any mechanics to the voice. So okay. I don't know if he's amped up my voice, but I would definitely just say, put it down, or just, whoa. And depending on the trajectory of the voice, it would create a resonance. And I don't really know. I wish I knew exactly how he plays with it.
But it's just now when you did it, it sounds like it does in the movie. Like it's actually terrifying. Like when she like it's scary when she does that. It really is.
I know it is. Actually, do you know a geeky thing which we? I wonder if I could look it up.
I'm gonna
text Denny. 2 seconds,
please.
Wait, you're just gonna text Denny? That's insane. Yeah.
She has this ability. She's your Rebecca Ferguson.
That's
for God's sake.
Crazy.
Wait, hi, hon. Who did the voice? I should just say the voice, right? Who did the voice for my blah, blah, blah voice in the first film? Was it Kathleen Turner?
That's amazing.
And if so, am I allowed to mention this? If not, it's too
all
late.
All of this is staying in.
Okay. It's sent.
Perfect. All right. So while we wait for his reply.
Yeah, I'm putting it up there.
The fact that we have you on, we have to bring this up.
Yes. Yeah. We've been waiting a long time to ask you about this. Sean, go.
One of the greatest stories ever told the Real Blend podcast.
Oh, no.
We're coming up on our 300th episode. So we've been doing this for about 6 years.
Sure.
Mike Flanagan is one of our most favorite guests.
Oh, I love him. I love him so much.
We did a 2-hour Dr. Sleep breakdown.
Of course you did.
And he told us the story about Jacob Tremblay's death.
Right.
On his birthday.
Right.
And the fake of Tremblay and, you know, the body that was made and there being, you know, him having a birthday cake immediately after covered in blood. I would love to hear your remembrance of that scene.
The performance is incredible, but it's not laughable. I don't know if I'm a part of the fake Tremblay joke, which is really sad because I feel like I missed out. And I feel like being one of the leads in that film, I'm never going to talk to him ever again. What the fuck? Right. What? I mean, what is that about? I'm going to text Michael right now.
You're texting everybody. I'm going to text Jacob.
No, I don't remember that story, but I do remember shooting that scene. And I remember being super cocky because someone had said to me, oh, are you going to feel really emotionally distraught, you know, tearing him to bits and eating him up? And I went, no, because I get paid to act, you know, something passive aggressive like that. And then we were rolling and I was getting ready. I got my knife, you know, I'm stretching in the background. And I remember that we dug down a camera and Jacob was lying kind of in a ditch. So you had his profile and then I could come into the shot so that you would have us both in profile, right? But we're both in profile. So I don't want to mess it up. He shouldn't mess it up. We're there for each other. And it's action. And all of a sudden, I hear this sound that is like a pig screaming before slaughter. Like, it is the most harrowing, and I'm standing. And I've never experienced it, ever. Tears just start pouring. And I'm like, shit. And I'm just wiping my face, thinking I'm going to ruin his take. And then I glide in and I'm literally, you can see in the shot, I think we're doing another one. I'm moving my head and wiping tears whilst filming this scene. And I have never experienced. And then cut. And I'm looking at him. He goes, Dad, could I have a Coke, please? And I'm like, yeah, cool.
Did you know it was his birthday when he shot that? Yeah. It was his birthday when he shot that scene. That's insane to
me. And his dad, who's a police officer, I think, super cool family. They're just like the coolest family ever. I was like, is he okay? He was like, yeah, God, yeah, he's great. He needs to stretch a bit. His foot is hurting from a football game or something. But other than, yeah, I was like, this boy is unreal.
Total pro.
I didn't get the cake. Was there a cake?
Yeah, there was a cake afterwards, and allegedly, unless Flanagan's pulling our leg, but he's a storyteller.
He is a storyteller, but he's a good one.
I love watching this film, obviously, because the scale and the scope of it are absolutely incredible. And your relationship with Timothy is remarkable to watch. And like that it's a really a beautiful thing. And there's a big twist that happens in this film with your character that I didn't see coming because I didn't read the book. And because this is going to come out after the movie's release, I'm talking about the Harkonnen aspect of your character. And I found that to be shocking. I did not see that coming.
Do you know what? There's a scene, and I've seen the footage out there, but they cut the scene. In the first... Did I just get a message from him? Sorry.
What did Denny say?
I thought it was Denny. No. I'll it wasn't. It was Mike Flanagan. But...
It's pretty good.
Thank you. There's a scene in the first film where... when our characters are kidnapped, right before we get thrown on the ornithopter, which we keep on calling the we had sex names for everything. And it's really annoying because I keep on mixing it up. And in interviews, I have to bite my tongue. The ornithopter is a horny throbber.
wait. Are there other ones? There's other ones besides that?
Dude, there were so many. I have to try to remember them. I mean, I have to text Timothy to ask. We're going to have the biggest chain of messages going through this interview. Oh, no, I can't say that one. Anyway, that's really good though. I'll say it when the cameras are off. But so there's a scene focus on in the first one, we get kidnapped, Paul and Jessica. Mm-hmm. Then there's a scene where Jessica is lying with her arms bound behind her back. And her legs. Have you seen the image?
Yeah.
And she's lying on this huge open space. It's a carpet. And you see it from a bird perspective, I think. And this tiny little fetal position, right? Now, what the scene is that they cut is all of a sudden you come down to her face and this thing in the background is just lowering himself on top of her. And rolls his body on her. And you see that it's Vladimir Harkonnen. And he's pushing air out of her so she can't breathe. And literally her eyes are nearly popping. And he whispers something in her ear. And it was cut.
Okay.
And my sadness is the fact that when you find out, it becomes a really odd dynamic, that scene, because it's oddly sensual and sexual and weird. And also it left us wondering what this relationship was. And I wonder if that's why he cut it. Because it did link us. That private moment really put us in a room by ourselves. There's one of my favorite scenes, which I was sad. I mean, it always happens, right?
Yeah. And the character whispered "Fake of Tremblay." That was the whisper. They whispered that into your ear. "Fake of Tremblay."
they are dragging us out of this room. We're so happy that you were able to come on the show.
Thank you, guys.
A delight to talk to you.
I can't believe we don't have an answer, but we're going to have to. I mean, I guess he's doing interviews, but you guys will find out. And I apologize if it's the wrong name and if someone else or, you know.
It doesn't matter. We loved having you on. Thank you for joining us. Please come back on the show anytime.
I will have me.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big money at Menards.
We'll be right back.
We want to thank our good friends at Warner Brothers for getting Rebecca Ferguson on the show. And of course, Rebecca, for joining us. Continue to track our Dune coverage as now that the movie's out, we can talk about it freely. But not this week, because this week we're getting to our full Academy Awards predictions. The show is pending. Who's hosting? Jimmy Kimmel? Is Kimmel the host?
Kimmel's the host.
Let me tell you how this show has fallen off. I used to be so invested in the host, the show. I mean, it's the season is 6.5 months. We've been talking about these movies since Oppenheimer came out in July. Oppenheimer and Barbie came out in July.
March 10th is way too late for the Oscars.
It's way too late.
The Oscars should be in January or early February. Yes. It's like the idea. Like, I also think I don't think it's a good look for the industry, because what I mean is, like, when I'm sitting here talking about the Oscars on my shows, they're like, wait, didn't that movie come out like a long time ago? And I'm like, yeah, sure, it did. And so
right now
it's
we're
very
excited
strange
about Dune. Right. Yeah, and we got to get people excited for these categories. However, the enthusiasm is going to run rampant on Real Blend this week. So let's turn it up, boys. We're going to go through each category. Everybody's going to give their picks. I will start off by naming the category, reading the nominees, and then we'll quickly go around the horn and give our picks. And we're starting with visual effects. So let me go over to the category here. And the nominees for visual effects are The Creator, Godzilla Minus One, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1, and Napoleon. Kevin, where are you going for visual effects?
I'm going Godzilla Minus One. I found that to be a brilliant film, but also just in terms of the budget and kind of how the visual effects looked. I also think I read a story that Spielberg, I think, has seen the movie 3 times. So I just kind of like started giving it weight a little bit. I think it was Spielberg. I'll double check. But that movie has really grasped, in my opinion, the Academy voters. So that's my pick.
Jake?
I think that's a really good pick, and that's really kind of what I was going back and forth between. I'm going to go with The Creator, if only because I feel like Godzilla, sort of that hype and the buzz has cooled down a little bit, and I know that Disney has really been putting out a lot of sort of Oscar screenings focused on the visual effects and bringing out a lot of the visual effects artists. So I feel like they're still kind of playing the game. I think if the awards, to y'all's point, had happened 6 weeks ago, I think far and away the Oscar would easily be won by Godzilla, and it still very well may be. But I feel like the visual effects organization, they're going to honor the people behind The Creator.
I am also going with The Creator, and specifically for Jake's reasoning, this little inside baseball, we get slammed by emails from publicists, and I have an inbox packed with emails about The Creator and visual effects opportunities, and hey, do you want to talk to our team and come to this screening and do this? I was like, all right, Creator, you got it. Here's your win. Also, I think that Garrett did an amazing job.
It's like, truly. I remember before when we saw The Creator, what was it, back in August, September? I remember thinking, okay, nothing's going to top that visually for visual effects. Nothing's going to beat that. It's beautiful, beautiful work.
And the cool thing about The Creator, as we had Gareth Edwards on the show, is that, you know, they shot this movie essentially on a consumer camera, if you to say it. And the visual effects are remarkable. And to Jake's point, it is between those two.
Yeah, I just feel there's not a bad choice if it's
the love for
those.
Godzilla seems, I mean, especially Spielberg seeing it 3 times. That's why I'm going to go with that one.
All right. Costume design. We have Barbie, Killers of the Flower Moon, Napoleon, Oppenheimer, and Poor Things. I'm going to go first, and I'm going to go with Oppenheimer. And this is one of my risky picks because it feels like Barbie and Poor Things are both in the conversation. But I just think the sheer number of cast members and the amount of work that has to be done in Oppenheimer. And I got a chance to interview Ellen Miroshnik. I want to make sure I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. Ellen Miroshnik, who worked on the film, and she talked at length about the suits that had to be chosen for the way that they photographed in black and white. And I don't know, I feel like costume nerds are going to get into something like that. So I'll go with Oppenheimer in this one. Jake, where are you?
I'm going to go with Barbie. I feel like anytime a movie has fashion in whether a direct or indirect way as a part of the plot. I feel like that kind of gives it the edge. I'm thinking about movies like Phantom Thread and stuff like that. And with Barbie, you know, the clothes that you put on the dolls is such a crucial part of what makes up the idea of Barbie and Ken. And, and it was truly incredible work, really remarkable work, very bright and outgoing. And so many of the different Barbies and the different Ken dolls had to have different personalities represented in their wardrobe. I was going back and forth between Barbie and Poor Things, but ultimately landed on Barbie.
Also, being a Ken doll yourself, having to dress yourself on a regular basis.
And trust me, it's tough. Am I going to wear my red suit or my blue suit?
I was going to say, you're wearing your Madam Web suit.
That's very true.
Kev, where are you going for costume design?
Yeah, so this is an interesting category. And a lot of the discussions that we have about Oscar predictions are based around the guilds and kind of which things have won over the years. And there was the Costume Designers Guild Award winners. I'm reading this on Variety. And they were spread out essentially between Barbie, Poor Things, and Saltburn, which I think is kind of creating that debate between Barbie and Poor Things. And it's interesting. I'm going to go with Barbie as well, even though Poor Things is kind of the one I had circled initially. But then I think about, like, it's so funny. Like, this makes no sense. But, like, every time I go to, like, an article based on costume design nominations, the top photo in every article is Barbie. And so, like, and again, I don't think that has any reason to believe it'll win, but it just seems like that image and that color pink, which was a huge story about they ran out of the color pink when they were making the movie. It just seems like also Barbie got snubbed in some categories. And I
not
think
just that
there's,
you know what costumes? The two of them roller skating through Venice
Beach. That's what I'm talking about.
Sure.
That's right? The picture. If you go to like I think it was on Variety's page, like I was looking up the costume design nominations or whatever. And that's the photo is Barbie and Ken on roller skates. So I had Poor Things circled, but I think it's going to be Barbie. I just feel like
talking myself out of it.
Yeah. Barbie.
I'm talking myself out. I'm staying with Oppenheimer, but I'm talking myself out of it.
Respectfully, I don't think it's going to be Oppenheimer.
It's not going to be Oppenheimer, because I think, again, this all also goes to the idea of, like, how many awards are you giving certain movies? Why don't we celebrate this film in this category? It's like I don't know. There's no rhyme or reason for it. But I think Barbie has remarkable costumes, and so does Oppenheimer, so does Poor Things. So they're all amazing.
Makeup and hairstyling. Here are your nominees. Golda, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Poor Things, and Society of the Snow. Kev, where are you going for makeup and hairstyling?
So this is, I think a lot of the chatter that I've seen has been a battle between Maestro and Poor Things. And what's interesting about, like, I think about Willem Dafoe's character in Poor Things and his face.
God, looks so good.
But then they put out, speaking about like things they put out that brilliant time lapse video of Bradley Cooper getting his makeup put on for Maestro. And now I'm torn. And I think it's so hard, but I'm going to go Maestro on this only because I feel like, I don't know. But then you have the controversy surrounding the film and there was a lot of talk about the prosthetics and different things like that. So now I'm curious if that's going to play into the nominations or the voting as well. That's a tough one. I'm going to go with Maestro.
All right. I am also going with Maestro for two reasons. A, I think the prosthetics conversation died down.
It did.
I think it was heavy at first. The family kind of weighed in.
Yes.
People saw the film, realized it wasn't a distraction necessarily.
He looks just like him.
This is a huge guild. The Makeup Guild recently had their awards and they split between Saltburn and Maestro. And Saltburn isn't even nominated in the category. So for that reason alone, I'm going with Maestro. Jakey, you're going to make it a sweep?
Oh, wait. Are you saying the guilds already gave this award?
The guilds gave their award. They have a fictional one and a...
Oh,
how do they call it? They have a fiction fantasy and then a reality.
And what won?
One and Maestro won. Oh, and well, and then Saltburn won in the fantasy realm kind of thing.
Now I feel better about my choice. Okay.
Yeah, I'm also going to go with Maestro. You're absolutely right. The nose controversy died down, I think, pretty quickly. Past that, him as Leonard Bernstein older in life was pretty raw. You guys know I was not a Maestro fan. That was truly remarkable makeup. That was,
and remember the first shot, Jake,
the
first
opening
shot
sequence.
It really is award worthy work. And honestly, I think it's what they did turning him into an older Leonard Bernstein later in life. to me, is leaps and bounds what they did to Willem Dafoe in Poor Things, which is good, but it still looks like a makeup job.
We were 5 minutes into Maestro, and Michelle, who didn't know anything about the movie and was just watching it, sitting down, and she turns to me and she goes, "Is that Bradley Cooper?" Like, yeah. She had no idea. Yeah. She didn't even know that he was in it.
The first shot when we go into him playing the piano, he's like doing some interview across the table. That is like, that's the moment. Like, when you start in that makeup, then you're immediately immersed in it. It's him. Crazy. Like, it's an incredible performance. And I do want to say, I found the online chatter towards Bradley Cooper this award season to be really disrespectful. I think he's a brilliant actor, and the tides turning on different people turning against Emma Stone, people turning against whoever's winning, Paul Giamatti, Cillian Murphy. It's like, why are people so angry? I mean, like, Cooper is a wonderful actor who is a great director, and it just doesn't really make sense to me. So I just want to point that out. I found that disrespectful.
I don't know if you spotted this, but Emma Stone's reaction to Lily Gladstone winning at the SAG.
Yeah. It was so genuine. It was so genuine.
Oh my God. Dude, it was great.
She's wanted Lily to win the whole time. Like, every time that Emma's won, I feel like she feels bad that Lily didn't win it, because that's just the way I take it. And I think in that moment, she was just so happy to hear it. And we'll get to that in the other conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. So great reaction. All right. Here's where things are going to start to get a little bit spicy. We have best song. And I don't mean this because The Fire Inside from Flamin' Hot is the first nominee, but it is.
I like that movie, by the way. I thought Eva Longoria did a good job with that film. It was good.
Do you think this is a difficult category?
Yes, I do.
Really?
I do.
Well, it's between two songs.
So The Fire Inside it is at all. From Flamin' Hot, the two Barbie songs, I'm Just Ken and What Was I Made For? It Never Went Away from American Symphony. And okay, Gabe, help me out here. What is this? I'm going to butcher it. And I'm going to
A Song for My People, I think, is how it translates.
For Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Jake, you seem confident.
Yeah, I think Billie Eilish wins again. I think it's what Was I Made For? I think the category tends to, you know, if what you guys are talking about is sort of the battle between I'm Just Ken and What Was I Made For, I just think they're going to lean toward a little bit more of the more serious song. The one that had a sort of a more emotionally resonant impact on the movie. I think I'm Just Ken was sort of a highlight of the movie for me. I think at the end of the day, they might, in terms of, you know, the quote unquote prestige of the Oscars, I think that they're going to sort of say, okay, that was a lot of fun and we're going to get to see him perform and there's your nomination, but we're going to give the Oscar to the quote unquote real song.
So that's how I feel. That's how I feel also. I mirror that. And my thought on it changed this morning, because I also thought it was going to be I'm Just Ken. Because to me, it was a highlight of the movie. And it's kind of when that big song and dance routine happens that I thought, like, okay, this film has really embraced the lunacy of what it can be. But I went back and rewatched the sequence that features the Billie Eilish song, and the use of footage, of existing home video footage of women over the years, is such a beautiful way to capture that quick emotional journey that Margot's Barbie is going through. And also taking the time to stop and actually listen to the song. It's a wonderful song.
The lyrics and the idea behind the sentiment, What Was I Made For?
Yeah.
In a movie about Barbie it's pretty remarkable.
I'm not putting it on the Jessie's song from Toy Story 2 just yet. You know, that's on a plateau that can't be touched. But this morning I thought it was I'm Just Ken, and now I'm switching over to Billie Eilish. Kev, agree, disagree? Where are you at?
So this one's like the toss up for me, because I'm Just Ken won the Globe, right? If I remember correctly. I think, or is it Critics' Choice?
No, he won Critics' Choice.
He won Critics' Choice, and Eilish won the Globe.
Okay, so Critics' Choice went to I'm Just Ken.
Because Gosling looks stunned.
Yeah.
When he won.
Is Billie Eilish performing her song at the Oscars?
I don't know.
That's a good question. There's been so much conversation about whether or not Ryan Gosling is. I feel like no one's really talking about. Yeah, that's confirmed. Yeah. But I feel like no one's asking whether or not Billie Eilish is.
So she's been just at almost all of the awards things like leading up to this. It's not. Yeah, she's been supporting the movie and the song. So
I guess if I'm just Ken. Yeah, I got to go with. I mean, to me, the best song is What Was I Made For? Mm-hmm. Though I do wonder, because the Oscars are having Ryan perform I'm Just Ken, they might want to go a little more fun. Though the songwriting in particular, I just feel like What Was I Made For is a better song. Billy does already have an Oscar for No Time to Die, right? Is it No Time to Die?
Sure. Yep.
Right. So I don't know. This is a tough one. I'm going to stick with What Was I Made For as well. But I think I'm Just Ken is right there. I don't think it's that easy.
All right. This one might be easier. Let's transition right into Best Original Score. We have Laura Cartman for American Fiction. John, is it Williams for Indiana Jones? Is that how that's pronounced?
Williams
and the Dial of Destiny. Yet another photograph of Jake and a legend that you'd want to track down.
Two.
Robbie Robertson for his phenomenal Killers of the Flower Moon score. Ludwig Göransson, friend of the Real Blend podcast, for Oppenheimer, and Jerskyn Fendricks for Poor Things. Kev, where are you going for score?
Ludwig, no question. I think Oppenheimer has this. I don't even have to say why. It's done.
Jakey?
Yeah, Oppenheimer. This is one of the one of the locks for what is going to be a big night for Christopher Nolan's movie.
And I think the moment it became a lock, I think it was already a lock the moment the movie hit. But I think it became a lock the day they did that live concert and the footage went viral. And then the Can You Hear the Music part is such an integral part of the film. And it's literally a comment about music. And then the music just scores you through this beautiful montage of Oppenheimer's mindset as he's traveling the world. I mean, literally, can you hear the music? It's just, there's no question.
So Ludwig's work is incredible, but I also do have to say that it's an opportunity to what? Would you push Williams into a record category, or is he already in a record category?
Not for that movie, no.
For wins? No, but I'm just saying overall, like, could you honor his body of work?
He's got five wins. I mean, I feel like if they were going to do it, remember last year there was the conversation, everyone thought he was going to, like, I feel like there was more of a conversation about his retirement whenever he did the Fablemans. Okay, I feel like if they were going to do what you're saying that they might do, they would have done it for the Fablemans. They're not going to do it for a poorly reviewed Indiana Jones movie.
All right. I want to shout out that the Poor Things score is great.
Yes, it is great.
And fits the material fantastically. Yeah. Also, Killers of the Flower Moon score, phenomenal.
I do just want to, for 30 seconds, let's just shout out Robbie Robertson, because he did pass away recently. His score for Killers of the Flower Moon is remarkable. I always thought it felt like a heartbeat. I think Scorsese said the same thing. And there's a really amazing aspect to that score that Robbie created. And I know that he's been a longtime collaborator with Scorsese and or over the years just in general in music and on all things, but just want to shout him out because his score was remarkable. I just think it's Ludwig's year.
I'm officially going with Ludwig for everyone who's keeping track at home. All right, production design. This could be some fun.
This is a tough one. This is one of the ones I had the toughest time with, if I'm being honest.
This one's going to be a challenge. We have Barbie, Killers of the Flower Moon, Nappy D, Napoleon, Oppenheimer, and Poor Things. Jake, where are you going?
On my notes, I have two movies scratched out about four or five times where I alternated and went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. I'm going to go with Barbie just because I feel like those sets... again, very much like the reason I voted for costume, it's so tied to so much of the movie and the plot of the movie, you know, Barbie's dreamland and the Mojo Dojo Casa House. I feel like that's such an integral part of the film, and those plot points don't work unless that production value is there. And bringing such an iconic aspect, a toy that is so memorable for a lot of people, to life, it was tough for me to not choose Poor Things. Mm-hmm. A movie that is so heavy and high quality production value. And this might be one I end up regretting, but I'm going to go with Barbie.
I'm going with Poor Things.
officially. It's not a bad pick. It's not a bad pick.
For this reason, because I was torn between the two. And the one thing that I think is going to not necessarily count against Barbie, but maybe push Poor Things over the top, is the number of scenes set in the actual world.
Yes.
Like when Barbie leaves the dream world. Poor Things is Bella's vision from start to finish. And each new land that you arrive at is distorted and twisted, you know, in a way that
the boat,
only
the boat land. Oh, it's the
boat's incredible.
Wild.
That Emma Stone had a quote recently about how much she's getting asked about her the nudity in the film. And she's like, what about that scene where Bella has to encounter, like, you know, scorched earth and death for the first thing? And she's like, how come nobody asks me about that? And the harrowing nature of God, like that set will, you know, is kind of lives with me forever. The amount of creativity that went into all of those sets. So for that reason, Poor Things is edging out Barbie for me. Kev, where are you falling?
Also on Poor Things, just because I want to say the whole movie was shot inside of a studio that they built every aspect of. I think that's the case because I've seen the production design, the behind the scenes photos. It looks like it looks like you're in a theme park. It's insane how they created this thing and the lighting, the way that this thing was done very uniquely. So, I mean, Yorgos is incredible. If you get a chance, check out the interview we did with Emma and Yorgos on our show. But yeah, Poor Things for me, please.
All right. This could be interesting. Let's go to sound. Best sound. We have the creator. We have Maestro. We have Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. We have Oppenheimer. And we have the Zone of Interest.
Is there really any debate here?
There was for me. I had a really tough time with this one.
Oh, I think this is done.
Go ahead.
The Zone of Interest. I mean, like, arguably some of the greatest sound design in the history of cinema. And that's the entire that's what the entire talking point and outside of the thematics of the movie, that's what everyone's talking about. And yes, you could argue Oppenheimer, of course, taking the sound out during the bomb explosion, dropping it back in. I mean, I remember sitting in a theater of Barbie and hearing the I could tell when the bomb went off in Oppenheimer because I felt the theater shake. So I understand the sound design in that movie, no question. But I don't think there's anything beating the Zone of Interest.
Okay, Jake.
I mean, and for people who don't know, like, the Zone of Interest is, according to the filmmakers, essentially it's two movies. It's there's a visual film and a sound film. They made an entire sound film that you never visually see, and because of the sound design, you are then entering into that world. That's what puts you there.
Please listen to our interview with Jonathan Glazer for more insight into that process. Jake,
I don't disagree with what Kevin's saying, but even still, I'm going to go with Oppenheimer. I feel like it's easier for Oppenheimer, the sound category is going to get sort of swept up in, you know, what is going to be, what people refer to sort of the Oscar package that is going to be handed to Oppenheimer that night. I think it's easier for, you know, the people who are advocating for themselves to just point at the bomb sequence and go, yeah, you remember the bomb scene, though, right? Like, yeah. And I think to Kevin's point, I think it's a little bit more complicated to explain maybe why the sound in the Zone of Interest is so absolutely phenomenal and honestly award worthy. And I just think that, you know, so much of, I mean, we're talking about the most popular scene from the most popular movie. It's, and so much of that is the sound of it. There's that picture that's going viral this morning of this guy who showed Oppenheimer to his parents, and they, 5 minutes before the bomb went off, they put their hands over their ears because they were prepared for what the sound was going to be. Kevin, you're not wrong about everything you said about the sound of from Zone of Interest, but I just feel like Oppenheimer is going to sort of just the wave of popularity is going to benefit the sound category.
I like how different.
It's an interesting year.
Yeah. I'm glad we don't have all the same things. It's nice.
I want to say this as well, too. This is why I'm going with Oppenheimer. Not that I disagree with anything said about the Zone of Interest, but this is where I want to bring up two interesting things. I think A24 has a challenge in getting Academy of members to sit down and watch Zone of Interest.
I would agree with that.
It's not the kind of film that you just pop in, you know, to breeze through. Secondly, I think to completely appreciate the sound design in it, you probably have to see it in a theater. Mm-hmm. And if a voter is watching it at home, I'm not quite sure that they're going to get the full mix the way that they should. So I think that that's going to end up becoming a category where we're like, it's really disappointing that Zone of Interest didn't win it. But I think people are just going to sort of down ballot go Oppenheimer on a couple of different things. And this might be one of those categories. So we'll see. Let's see. Where are we going next? Film editing. Sorry, I should have jumped ahead here. And here are your nominees in the category of film editing. Anatomy of a Fall, our first mention of Anatomy of a Fall, a film that people thought was going to be a contender in a number of different categories. The Holdovers, of The Holdovers.
Anatomy of a Fall is a contender in a lot of categories.
I just thought we'd be mentioning it before this.
Oh, I see.
The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Oppenheimer, and Poor Things. Jake, where are you going?
I think this is a very easy win for Oppenheimer. The editing of the back and forth between the different timelines, and the fact that, you know, they made a small hearing in a tiny room feel like an action scene in the final act. You know, that's, yes, a lot of that is the writing, and a lot of that goes to Nolan, but a huge credit needs to be given to the editing. That made that the movie feel the way it did. It's a mostly talking movie about physics, and it plays better than most action movies I'm seeing these days. And I think you have to say that that's the editing.
If it's not Oppenheimer, I'm dumbfounded because of exactly what you just said. The way that it fluidly transitions between its different storylines and never loses you. Like, with visual cues that point out when you're in, you know, someone's point of view, or you're in the past, the present, or the future later on when he's being interrogated. It is seamless. And a lot of it's screenplay, which we'll get to, but a lot of it's editing. And I'm floored by the editing in Oppenheimer. So I have to go with that. Kev, I'm assuming you will as well.
Yeah, I mean, those cues you're talking about, like, there's like one of my favorite edits in Oppenheimer is, I think it transitions from Oppie's POV in color to Strauss's POV in black and white. And it jumps from like an IMAX 1.43 shot to a 2.20 normal, like a widescreen shot that doesn't have the full IMAX. And the way that cut is done is through a match strike from Oppenheimer. As we enter into the black and white, it's like, And you don't even notice the shift. And I think what Chris Nolan over the years, and I think Jennifer Lame, who edited this film, you have to kind of hide those format changes, especially if it's a narrative aspect. And remember, he's dealing with multiple formats, black and white IMAX, black and white widescreen, you know, or 2.20, whatever. The format editing on this movie is in itself is why I think it's going to win. But just in general, you're right. The pacing of this thing, there's not an ounce of fat on this movie. Not a single moment wasted.
Which is ironic then, because Killers of the Flower Moon, you know, it's critiqued about it being too long, and yet it makes its way into the editing category. So,
but Oppenheimer feels like it's 45 minutes long. That's why it's going to win,
which is crazy. Yes, Jake.
I was going to jump in really quick. They did just confirm Billie Eilish set to perform at the Oscars.
There we go.
I know we were talking about that.
All right. This one may seem relatively easy, but I want to shout out the films that are nominated in the category. It's Best International Feature Film. We have Io Capitano from Italy, Perfect Days from Japan, Society of the Snow from Spain, The Teacher's Lounge from Germany, and then The Zone of Interest. I am going with Zone of Interest, but have seen Teacher's Lounge and Perfect Days, and they're both fantastic. And I've heard nothing but amazing things about Society of the Snow, which is a Netflix film from my guy. Jay Bayona, that's right. Thank you very much. So I definitely want to catch up with that. But that's a strong category that I think is going to get dominated by The Zone of Interest. Jake, I know you were saying that you think it's lining up to be the win for this movie.
I think there are some instances, I think, where the Academy really does like a movie, but also acknowledges, like, we can't give you a majority of the awards we nominated you for. I think of the most famous example being Pulp Fiction. So they kind of dictate all of their, all of their love to one win in the same way. You know, they gave, you know, Quentin Best Original Screenplay. I think this is going to be the win of the night for international feature.
Kev, do you see an upset?
No. Zone of Interest, 100% winning this award. In fact, I I could argue the Zone of Interest could win Best Picture. I don't think it will, but that's when people see this movie, you'll understand.
That would be interesting. All right, let's get the documentary feature film. We have Bobby Wine, the People's President, The Eternal Memory, Four Daughters, To Kill a Tiger, and 20 Days in Maripol. Kev, where are you going for documentary feature film?
I'm just going to be completely transparent. I have not seen any of these films. So just clarifying that. I'm going to go with 20 Days just because, I don't know, just picking 20 Days. To be honest with you, I think the reason why I picked it was because I was searching articles on the nominations, and that was the photo that popped up at the top of one of the articles. And I was like, okay, that's what I'm going to go. Kev,
I haven't seen any of these documentaries either. I'm a little embarrassed of myself. Same. I used to love the documentary category, but I just haven't paid attention to them this year. So I went to our good friends at Gold Derby, and most of them picked 20 Days in Maripol. So let's go, guys. Help me out. Help my poll.
How Jake? Dare you? I have not only have I seen all five of them, I've watched them each five times. Yes. And through that expert knowledge, I choose 20 Days in Maripol.
Hey, good.
Jake, why are you choosing that one? I know you haven't seen any of them.
Same thing. I mean, like, as someone I follow, the Oscar race pretty closely. I watch YouTube videos on Oscar experts. I really do enjoy this season, and fun. I watch a lot of stuff. And that seems to be sort of the odds on favorite. And in the same way that, you know, people can gauge who's going to win the Super Bowl without knowing anything about football based on like what people around them are saying. So, you know, it's nothing wrong with that. You can still, you know, so that's why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. We're going to get into some of the bigger categories in a heartbeat. Let's throw it to a quick break and then we'll regroup on the other side. And we are back. All right. Getting to the nitty gritty cinematography. We have El Conde, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, and Poor Things. That is a stacked category, my friends. Kev, you love cinematography more than the rest of us. Well, kidding. I do. Where are you going with this one?
Love it. Oitema, no question. I think this is locked. I haven't seen the guilds or the if they already did the awards for cinematographers. Do you know if they did them already, Jake?
I don't think they have.
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think it matters whether they did or not. I think there's one correct answer.
So I'm going to go with Oppenheimer again. Similar feeling that I have with the editing in the film, the multiple formats, the way that Hoytema framed these shots, shot these sequences. I mean, probably the most iconic, I shouldn't use the word iconic. I think one of the most like famous images of movies this year is that shot of Oppenheimer's face as he's standing at the pond and just the rain coming down. And then like the look of like, you know, on his face. I think that shot is just like, that's it right there. That's the frame of the movie. That's the character.
What about the look on your face when we interviewed Hoyta?
Oh, dude, don't even get me started. I flew down to Georgia and back in the same day on my own dime just to meet him. I was so
to hang out in a green room and talk Oppenheimer. And I'll point out again, as we mentioned in an interview recently, they were screening Oppenheimer and Hoyta was honored before the screening. And that theater
erupted,
burst out into thunderous applause that Kevin and I could hear.
You would have thought the Rolling Stones were playing. Yeah, it was unbelievable.
I'm also going with Hoyta Van Hoytema, who is getting a well-deserved Oscar in this category. Jake, you gonna divert?
Same. I'm with you guys. So then I'm going to yield my time by asking you a question. In an alternate universe where Dune Part 2 came out in November, who wins the Oscar?
Oppenheimer.
I think so, too.
Wow. Yeah, I think so, too.
I think we don't live in that alternate universe.
Yes.
I think it's that good, honestly. Let me ask a devil's advocate question as well, too. In an alternate universe where Rodrigo gets nominated for Barbie instead of Killers, is it more of a competition?
No, I actually think his work is infinitely better in Killers than it is in Barbie.
Interesting.
You've got the wide vistas and you've got the opening shot alone.
They're very different.
Yeah, they are different, but the opening shot alone of you know, the Osage tribe, you know, dancing in slow motion to the oil falling.
Yeah,
I mean, that alone is the sort of shot that in any other year would have won him the Oscar.
I always like the shot. I think it's DiCaprio's entrance shot where like the camera comes into the train and he's like getting off. And it's just like old school filmmaking. It's like, yeah, it's a really, it's a brilliant. And I think the juxtaposition between the shots in Barbie and Killers of the Flower Moon just show you the range of Rodrigo Prieto, who's just an absolute mastermind of a cinematographer.
All right, let's get into some screenplay action. Original screenplay: Anatomy of a Fall, The Holdovers, Maestro, May December, and Past Lives. Yes, Kevin.
Question. So, forgive me if I don't have this right, but the WGA Awards, which are the Guild Awards for the writers, I feel like they in the past they've happened before the Oscars, so then we can kind of think about it. But I don't think the WGA Awards this year are until April 14th, which is after Oscars.
They just put the nominations out,
which is weird. Is that normal?
Hey, everything was affected like by this the year. Strike. Was it affected by the strike?
I don't know, but I just wanted to, I normally, I think, would look at it and go, oh, well, that won the WGA, so this is what's probably going to win the Oscar. We don't know who won the WGA. So I'll just give mine real quick and just say it's Anatomy of a Fall. I think that script has been talked about heavily. Everyone is breaking that script down. We're all questioning the ending. Yeah, I think there's no way that it doesn't win.
Jake, where are you going?
I'm also going Anatomy of a Fall, and you know, similar to what Kevin said, but also in the same way, like Zone of Interest, where sort of like this seems to be the Oscar that they're giving. And I really think the Academy loved this movie a lot, but unfortunately, it came out in a year where a lot of categories have just got someone that's just a little bit better, or they're better or not, it's going to win instead. But original screenplay, I think, is their chance to go, okay, here's Anatomy of a Fall's Oscar for this year.
Yeah, I'm also going Anatomy of a Fall, but I wish that in keeping with that tradition that they were honoring Past Lives, because I don't know if Past Lives is going to get anything else, and I would love for Past Lives to have an Oscar.
Yeah.
So that would be fantastic. Let's shift over to adapted screenplay then. We have American Fiction, Barbie, Oppenheimer, Poor Things, and The Zone of Interest. Jakey, where are you going for adaptive screenplay?
I'm going American Fiction. I feel like the screenplay for that has just been surging. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this is one of those categories where the winner was sort of dictated by when the awards are happening. Because I think, you know, 8 weeks ago, it could have been Barbie. 6 weeks ago, it could have been The Holdovers. And just, I think American Fiction is the beneficiary of surging at just the right moment. And I think it surged at a time when people were voting. You know, almost every one of these movies had a moment where it could have been the winner. And I think you could make the argument as to who's the most deserving, but I think American Fiction benefits from the Oscar timeline of this year.
Have you read American Prometheus? Do you think it's going to get an Oscar?
So, okay. I mean, this comes down to what I think should win and what I think is actually going to win. So I think American Fiction is going to win this. It just seemed like to Jake's point, it feels like the script that feels like it's going to win.
Yeah. Sorry. Do you think the working title of American Prometheus was American Nonfiction?
pretty good.
Thank you.
That was really good. That was pretty good.
Can someone tell me how many awards American Fiction's already won so far? I think
I'll take a look if you want to keep going.
That script has won a few awards already in this category, if I'm not mistaken.
Let me ask you something. Do you guys, I am a believer in that sometimes, whether it's right or not, the Oscars choose to spread the wealth a little bit. And, right. I really don't see how you look at American Prometheus and not be in awe of how that was adapted into the Oppenheimer screenplay.
I don't understand. How do you think that they can spread the love when no one else knows what everyone else? It's not that they all got together.
I think that everyone can pretty much universally say Nolan's going to win director, Oppenheimer's going to win picture. So we don't need to give him screenplay too. But I really do feel like that's going to be a lot of people's thinking.
I want to point out. Screenplay is
incredible, though.
I know we have to move on, but Cord Jefferson did win the BAFTA for screenplay. And I think that's kind of why I started thinking American Fiction was going to start winning.
And Critics' Choice.
Critics' Choice. So thank you, Gabe. My argument real quick for Oppenheimer, and then I know we got to move on. Oppenheimer is, you're taking a 700-page book and you're turning it into a 3-hour film. But also Oppenheimer did something that no screenplay that I've ever seen has done. And that's put Oppenheimer's perspective in the first person. And when you read this screenplay, for example, when you're in the middle of the Trinity test sequence, you are in Oppenheimer's head as he's thinking about. So all the things that come across Killian's face in the movie are internalized, written out, like in I stand here and do this. I'm walking into this room. And then all of Strauss's perspective, the black and white sequences are written in third person like normal. So in my opinion, from a screenplay perspective, if you're giving the best adapted screenplay award, to take a 700-page book, turn it into a 3-hour film, and then also make a unique jump that makes the film better by giving your actors. I know.
They're not going to.
But you're not going to pick it.
That's not how any of this works.
No, I'm saying to Kevin, pick it.
But this is a game. I'm playing you guys. So like, I know American Fiction's going to win because, as Gabe just said, it won BAFTA and it won Critics' Choice. I'm just making the argument as to why I think Oppenheimer should win that award. That's all.
Okay. Critics' Choice has no impact on the Academy whatsoever, which is why I'm choosing Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer's a better script.
It's not going to win, though.
When does that ever matter?
It doesn't matter.
Dude, it doesn't matter. I know Oppenheimer's a better script, but I'm telling
American
you
American Fiction isn't even a good script. I don't really think American Fiction's a good script.
You're wrong. American Fiction's a fantastic script. It's just not.
There's a subplot in American Fiction that I cannot forgive, which is the fact that he writes a book in about a week's time. Like, I'll never process
the timeline of that. In a week time.
He still writes a book.
Yeah, but what would you know about writing books?
A lot. And it takes two and a half years.
You seem to shit him out pretty quick. Yeah.
Sure feels that way.
I do want to say, because I'm not going to take any American Fiction negativity here. That movie is great. American Fiction is a phenomenal film. It really is.
All the family stuff and the character stuff is tremendous. But I can't stand that literary subplot, man. It bugs me to no end how quickly that stuff moves through.
I mean, you could pick that apart in any movie ever made that a character did something. That's a huge plot point.
That's a huge plot point of that movie.
Right. Well, you're picking Oppenheimer for real?
I'm picking Oppenheimer. Yeah.
You just lost that category.
I like that pick. You're going to lose that category.
That's a spicy pick, but I like that pick.
I mean, it should win. It deserves to win.
Well, I'll tell you, as someone looking at the chart, you got a lot of similar picks from you guys. So this is a make or break. It's a high risk, high reward for Sean in the game.
And listen, American Fiction may get read, that evening, but no one will believe it. No one will believe that that's a better screenplay.
No one will be happier if Oppenheimer gets picked.
I know.
Than me. Because I want that. Like, that script is one of the greatest scripts I've ever written. I've ever read. It's brilliant on every level.
Well, no one might be happier than you. Because
you know what I mean, though. I mean, I would be happy to be wrong is the point I'm making.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Animated feature. The Boy and the Heron. Elemental. Nimona. Robot Dreams. And Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. I'm going with Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse.
Same. That's my pick as well.
Same. It honestly should have gotten a Best Picture nomination.
Yes, it should have. I totally agree. The only thing I could see is if Miyazaki gets something for The Boy and the Heron. But, I think...
I feel like Spider-Man's been surging these past few weeks. I feel like Boy and the Heron had a moment. But Spider-Man, I feel like, has kind of pulled out.
All right. These are the top categories now, the big, big categories.
But that's why it's kind of boring, is I feel like the big, big categories are kind of done.
They do feel like they're a little bit done. And so maybe someone will get a little bit spicy and break things up for the benefit of. But you're right, Sean.
You guys,
our competition tends to come down to the below the lines type categories.
Don't forget Glenn Close, Olivia Colman.
Yeah,
sure.
That's true.
Don't forget
that. And Lady Gaga. Supporting actress, we have Emily Blunt, Danielle Brooks, America Ferreira, Jodie Foster, and Divine Joy Randolph, who I am picking.
Yeah. Divine's won everything. It's a phenomenal performance. I this is a great category, and I want to shout out everybody in this category because Emily Blunt's final scene, or that scene in the gray board interrogation, is brilliant with Jason Clarke. America, I've been singing her praises all season. That monologue is amazing. I mean, Danielle Brooks, I kind of wish Danielle Brooks was a little more of a front runner as well. I just think her performance, she commands that movie. She is like, she really commands that presence in that film. She's so great in that movie. But I think it's going to be Dave Vine, and I'm totally happy with that. I think she's wonderful in The Holdovers.
Where were you watch The Holdovers on my birthday, actually? And Michelle had not seen it. And it's the first time through, I was so focused on Giamatti and his relationship with Dominic Sessa. And this time I paid super close attention to Divine's subplot and how emotional it is with her, like losing her son and bringing his stuff back to her sister's home and dropping it off in the drawer. And it's just truly heartbreaking stuff. Really great. Really, really great. So I'm happy that she's been winning everything up to this point. So we're all going with Divine Joy Randolph, supporting actor. Again, kind of feels like we have a front runner here, but the nominees are Sterling K. Brown for American Fiction, Robert De Niro for Killers of the Flower Moon, Robert Downey Jr. for Oppenheimer, Ryan Gosling for Barbie, and Mark Ruffalo for Poor Things. Kev?
I mean, it's Robert Downey Jr., and deservedly so. It's a brilliant performance. I think we all knew he was going to win the moment we sat down for the first time and watched it at AMC Lincoln Square in 70mm IMAX, and he has his final blowout sequence when he's just like, you know, just laying everything out for Alden. And it's just, there's also a smirk that he gives. I remember talking to Robert Downey Jr. at the Critics' Choice about that smirk, and he didn't even remember that he does it. And he's like,
really?
I remember what he said. Yeah. Cause like, there's a smirk that he gives, like in the, it's the scene when they're in the AEC meeting.
He's going out to talk to the press.
AEC meeting. And he's like, about having to let Truman know about what's going on with the bomb. And he kind of goes like that with his lips. I don't know what he does in that scene, but I just remember seeing that going, oh, this dude's locked in. Like he's just in that guy, in that character. He became Strauss. As somebody who read American Prometheus, like he captured just the essence of just who that guy was, at least the way I think he was portrayed. So yeah, he was incredible.
I can't say I was ready to call it for him having just seen the movie. I mean, I thought he was incredible. I thought everybody in the ensemble was incredible. But it's been really rewarding to see Downey build this momentum through the award season, you know, and collect each of the key sort of trophies along the way. And he does. We talk about this every year. There's somebody who figures out how to do this. He's disarmingly charming in each of his speeches. He pokes fun at himself. He's lavishing praise on his wife, who was so supportive of him, you know, throughout the course of his career. And it just feels like it's his time. And so, I'm going Downey as well, too. Jake, I assume you are as well.
Yeah, it's Downey. I got to be honest. I do feel I wish at some point Gosling had won something. That's just such a great, iconic, I think will be memorable performance for many years. And it's a bummer that I kind of feel like he just sort of blanked the whole season. That's the flip side of Downey dominating. I got to ask you, do you guys think that like every single award show for just a brief moment, Robert De Niro thinks he won?
They're trying to read it.
That'd be great if someone paused on it. Robert Downey Jr. All right, actress. Best actress. We have Annette Bening for Naiad, Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon, Sandra Hüller for Anatomy of a Fall, Carey Mulligan for Maestro, and Emma Stone for Poor Things. This could shake up the race a little bit. Depending on where people want to go. I'm going to go Emma Stone in Poor Things. I think I'd have to really think about this, but I think it's the best performance I saw last year. It floored me the minute I saw it. It's her, essentially her movie from start to finish. I gotta go Emma Stone for Poor Things. I think she's going to be a 2-time Academy Award winner.
I'm going to go Lily Gladstone. I think her story is incredible. The whole bit about like her being an Oscar winner in her high school yearbook is hilarious and just kind of a fun through line to her whole story. But that being said, her performance is remarkable. I still think the sequence at the bottom of the stairs when DiCaprio walks out to tell her about the death and she just breaks down. That whole movie rests on her reactions to the horrifying things that are happening. And every single time someone passes away, the cut to her face and the look on her face, she carries all that weight there, all the emotional weight of those moments. And I think, while I think Emma Stone's performance is brilliant as well, you're 100% right. I also want to shout out Carey Mulligan because I think she's brilliant in Maestro.
I love her in that movie.
And Sandra Hüller is amazing in Anatomy Fall. So I think right now, so you're looking at the category, right? So Jake, correct me if I'm wrong. Gladstone and Emma both won the Globe, comedy and drama. And then SAG went to Gladstone, which is a huge thing because the actors vote for SAG and they're the biggest branch of the Academy.
BAFTA went to Emma Stone.
But I don't think Gladstone had a nomination at BAFTA. Am I wrong on that? Can someone?
Gladstone did not get nominated for BAFTA.
Right. Okay. So she had no chance to win there and because she wasn't nominated. So I'm going to go Gladstone. I also think her speeches have, especially the Golden Globe one, there's an emotional aspect to it. I think I saw a story the other day that Kate Winslet was talking about her speech at the Globes or something like that. And people were just like taken aback emotionally by Gladstone's words and speeches. So I see that happening. I think this was all solidified over the weekend when she won SAG. Same with Killian, but we'll get to that.
Okay. Jake.
Yeah, I'm going Lily Gladstone. I feel like there's more of, you know, if we're looking at this from a cold, calculated standpoint in terms of the value of past wins, I think there's more value in a SAG win than there is a BAFTA win.
Yeah. Especially when she wasn't even nominated for the BAFTA.
Yeah, exactly. I really just can't imagine there's going to be a third Martin Scorsese movie that goes 0-10 at the Oscars. Yeah. And if Lily doesn't win this, then that will be after Gangs of New York and The Irishman. It will be his third 0-10.
I'll tell you this, though. I don't think that there's a lot of love for that movie. I just don't see the passion for it.
The reason I would almost back you up, Sean, is that it did not get a screenplay nomination.
Yeah.
And Killers not getting a screenplay nomination, I thought was very telling.
But
one thing.
And also, Emma's performance is incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And I think that there's certain people who the Academy doesn't want to have be two-time Academy Award winner. And I don't think Emma Stone is that person. You know, I think that they're really happy with her filmography and what else she can accomplish.
We have to remember, too, you know, there's nothing wrong with someone winning a second Oscar. Don't forget, Silence of the Lambs was Jodie Foster's second Oscar a few years after she won her first. So if people subscribed to this idea of, oh, it's been too soon since they won their first Oscar, then Jodie Foster wouldn't have her Clarice Starling Oscar, which is one of my favorite Oscar wins ever. So yeah. If someone deserves an Oscar, they deserve an Oscar. You know,
Did she win for now?
I'm going to punch you in the face.
Miss Chicopee? What did she win for? Oh, The Accused. She won for The Accused, right? That's right.
Same thing with Daniel Day-Lewis and There Will Be Blood in Lincoln. Both deserving.
Yeah. All right. Best actor. Bradley Cooper for Maestro. Colman Domingo for Rustin. Paul Giamatti for The Holdovers. Cillian Murphy for Oppenheimer. And Jeffrey Wright for American Fiction. Should be, I'm going to say, Giamatti. But Cillian Murphy's going to win it. Jake. No,
it should be Cillian.
I love Giamatti's performance so much. I'm a huge fan of Giamatti, and there was a moment where I really thought this was going to be his moment. But tide seems to be swinging in the way of Cillian, so I'm going to go with Cillian.
Kev?
And I love Giamatti's performance, but Cillian carries that entire film. I think Giamatti, while I know that Cillian is helped by an incredible ensemble, he is the film. I'm not going to be mad. Yeah. And I think Giamatti, a lot of Giamatti to me relies upon his other actors, as does Cillian. I'm not saying it doesn't, but I just think that there's a strong force with Killian's performance that I think is so singular in a way that I think he's going to win. He won the SAG. You have to remember he won the SAG. Yeah. Who won BAFTA?
Cillian.
Oh, Cillian did. Yeah.
It's hard to argue against giving, you know, Oppenheimer all these Oscars except for the guy who fucking plays Oppenheimer. But I do think that there's not enough credit being given to the fact that, like, Giamatti just created a character out of thin, like, it's entirely him.
It was
it's not based on.
It was written a little too close to the sun.
he didn't make it up, that character. It was written for him.
I mean, he did the work of creating.
I'm not saying
the character.
He didn't, it's not like he made the character.
There's just something a little different between playing a real person versus creating the mannerisms, of a person who never existed.
I would push back on that because there's like outside of, you know, the footage that we have of Oppenheimer, a lot of Killian's work had to be done without things that he knew, how Oppenheimer operated in these certain situations, how he would have carried himself. Like I would argue that Killian had just as much work to do as Giamatti did, if not more, even though the person lived. I think there's behind the closed doors moments that we don't have footage of are where his performance really shines.
It's so, a tough role. Yeah. Well, actually, they both have tough roles because they both play unlikable people for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're protagonists that you have you warm up to them if you ever do. Giamatti, I guess that you do for sure. He has that third arc sort of redeeming it. All right. These next two will be pretty easy, but we'll give credit where credit is due by listing the nominees. We have Best Director, Justine Triet for Anatomy of a Fall, Marty Scorsese, Killers of the Flower Moon, Yorgos Lanthimos, Poor Things, Jonathan Glazer, The Zone of Interest, and Chrissy Poo Nolan for Oppenheimer.
As he likes to be called.
Who may or may not be good friends with Denis Villeneuve, we're not quite sure. Unconfirmed Chrissy. At the moment.
Sean, Nolan, right? Before we continue, I have to tell you, I'm not friends with Christopher Nolan.
It's Nolan's year.
He was so adamant to tell us that.
It's Nolan's year. It'll be Denis' year next year, but it's Nolan's year this year. And which, you know what? This brings me such joy because I'm not. Of the three of us, you guys know that I'm the least Nolan apologist of the three, but I don't like living in a world where Christopher Nolan doesn't have an Oscar. Like, that's just silly
for this film in particular.
I was saying, what a cool movie for him to win for. Yeah,
100%. Yeah, I would argue it's his best film. So
yeah,
Nolan, Jake, I'm assuming you're Nolan.
Yeah, that's, you know, it kind of makes me happy in the same way that, like, obviously different films, it's not apples and oranges, but like in the same way that we love all of Nolan's work, but like Oppenheimer is what he deserved to win for. I love all of Spielberg's films. He deserved Best Director for Schindler's and Saving Private Ryan. Like, he won his Oscars for the right movie in the same way that I feel like Nolan is winning for the right movie.
Kev. Well, also, I just think
Kevin, I'd like to know who you're choosing.
Kev, shock the world.
I mean, obviously it's Nolan. But I do think that this is finally, and I'm not saying that Nolan didn't have the prestige that he has now. Years ago, obviously The Dark Knight and Interstellar and all those films and Dunkirk put him on an elevated status of a filmmaker. And I do believe that now he's crossed into like the greatest of all time conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think the reaction we had from Denny on the show last week when we had him on, it just shows you the level that Nolan is operating at, and like the level Denis is operating at is a level that we all think is masterful. I was saying, for that guy, for Denis to like look at Nolan like that, I know I'm hyperbolic about a lot of things, but I do believe there's a conversation that could be had now about Nolan being the greatest or one of the greatest of all time. And I think Spielberg, you know, will forever kind of have that, in my opinion. But I think Nolan is really kind of this film crossed him into a different stratosphere. Not that he already wasn't there. He was kind of already peaking up there. But now he's kind of like just chilling up there.
Yeah, what were you going to throw in?
Well, I was going to say, I think it's because this film is so grounded. I think that like before this, everything was, he was regarded for just how complicated his movies were.
Sure.
They were always made this well, but he was able to make a movie at this degree and then turn it on its head in some other way, whether it's time manipulation or what have you. And this one, it feels like there's always been the sort of like Nolan bros online that have been like, he's the best ever. But this is finally where it's a bit more straightforward. It is a tough film and very hard to do, but it's a period piece about a historical event that everyone in the world is aware of, and he handles it with the grace of a master while also still making a Christopher Nolan movie. And I think that's why it feels like he's crossed the threshold.
This also sounds really stupid, but I think that Nolan has turned the corner of just being outside of our film community bubble, recognized by one name. No, but one name.
Yeah.
Like Nolan. You could say Fincher, you know, you could say Tarantino, you could say Scorsese, Spielberg. Yeah. Like legitimately when we talk about them, we just say Spielberg. But really now, honestly, that's what it is.
I didn't realize
a great filmmaker in his own right.
I saw an interview the other day. I didn't realize that Jonathan wrote the line in Dark Knight about the hero you live long enough. I didn't know Jonathan wrote that line. That's such a I saw that in an interview recently. I was like, because Nolan talked about that line. And I was like, wow, Jonathan wrote that line. That's crazy.
But then with Denis, it's Denis.
It's because no one can pronounce Villeneuve.
Right. Well, Denis just works for him. Are there any other filmmakers we call from first name? We say Kubrick. We say Hitchcock. Marty. We say
Marty.
Marty. Yeah.
Ooh,
Marty.
Interesting.
That's more for fun. Yeah, it's more for fun.
Okay.
All right, picture. Oh, let me get that. Oh, yeah, I have him. Here we go. American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, and The Zone of Interest. I'm going with Oppenheimer. Kevin's going with. Jake is going with.
Oppie.
Here we go. There's a lot of conversation about this being the strongest slate of Best Picture nominees that we've seen in years, if ever.
Just real quick around the horn.
Do you think so? Do you think these are?
I would say since 2007. Well, you know, which would be the 2008 Best Picture nominees, which had No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
There Will Be Blood. There Will Be Blood.
And you know what it is? Like
Michael Clayton, I think.
No franchises, you know, no sequels. No, these are all original films, strong filmmakers. Yeah. But I mean, like no big IP. Well, I guess Barbie's pretty big IP. Never mind. The points I'm trying to make are all false.
But actually, to Sean's point, and I think what Gabe's about to say, I don't believe I don't believe Barbie should be an adapted screenplay. I don't believe that. I think that should be an original screenplay. I know it's based on IP, but that script is original in its own. You know what I'm saying? I don't get that.
What I was going to say about, you know, you mentioning Barbie as a franchise, it's not a story telling franchise, I think, is why Barbie feels like it's exactly what Denis said in our interview about being in awe of Greta being able to make what she did based on this line of toys. Whereas opposed to the look at Transformers, it's technically a line of toys, but it's always been about, you know, the animated show and all these stories about the world that they live in. Barbie feels very singular in that it's about the culture built around this object. It's franchise, but it's a new original franchise.
Keep in mind, Logan got a Best Adapted Screenplay nomination, not because it was adapted from a very specific comic book or anything, but just because that's just the Academy rule. All the people that were pushing for, were deciding whether or not it should be original or should be adapted. Academy has a rule. And that's just what it is, you know. The Dark Knight, Logan, you know, like these. It doesn't matter if it's an established character of which there are already traits out there that are sort of established with the character. Then that's adapted.
And to be fair with Barbie, not that these are necessarily story points, but all the characters, like, you know, there's a big part of that movie that people grabbed onto was that, like, she had like all these deep pulls from these specific models of Barbie and these specific characters that were based on these specific dolls. And I think that you could argue that that's very similarly, you know, if you're going to make a movie about Wolverine, you're being inspired by all these stories that were written before it, in a sense.
All right, your turn. Head to the comments down below and tell us your predictions heading into the Oscars telecast. Maybe any places you disagree with us, or if you're willing to take a huge left turn on a category. I want to hear it from you guys before the ceremony airs on Sunday. In the meantime, follow us on social media. We are at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. We appreciate you guys tuning in to listen. We'll be back next week with episode number 302. And until then,
Dunkirk. I'm bringing that back. I don't care. I love that one.